You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy.
I wanted to fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music. Wanted to be left alone in public, excuse me. I wanted my cake and eat it too. I wanted it both ways. Fame made me a balloon. Cause my ego inflated when I blew sleep. It was confusing. Cause all I wanted to do was be the Bruce Lee.
A very good Wednesday morning to you. And I have to tell you, I'm fired up today. Yeah, today's show's going to be awesome. Not that all the shows aren't good. Some are better than others. When you're in the entertainment business, you know that. You do your best every day, but by hook or crook, some are better. Today's going to be better. And I'm fired up about it because I've already heard it, and I liked it. And it's going to be a fast show, too. So here's what we're doing. A month ago maybe, Bob Nielsen forwarded me a YouTube video. And, you know, we've talked about the Vietnam War series on PBS. And, you know, I didn't fight there. And so you watch it, and I thought it was a relatively balanced presentation. But I'm beginning to change my mind. And you're going to hear why. Bob Del Vecchio, you're going to hear. And you're going to hear a presentation that he gave about it. He's a former Marine Corps combat cameraman or correspondent. I forget which, and I'm not really sure I know the difference. I think they do a lot of the same things. Maybe they weren't designed to by MOS, but I think functionally they do. So anyway, in Vietnam, and he taught, and so he's part of a group that, you know, talks about factual history relative to Vietnam. And you'll hear, his thoughts on the Burns Novick, PBS show. And you'll hear him talk about them using his images in the wrong year and not telling the facts, but not telling the complete story. And then, so thus by cherry picking, information and not telling it completely, the mosaic isn't complete. So you'll hear him here in the next 26 minutes. You'll hear him. And Bob Nielsen's going to give a short intro to it because he sent it to me. And as a Vietnam veteran, I want you to hear why this stuff is important to them. And then after that, we're going to do our first battlefield study, which I'm fired up about. So you can go to the website right now. And if you go to the podcast page, you'll see an entry there that says Battlefield Studies Maps. So go ahead and click on that. Gulf 2-4 fights in Ramadi, April 6th and 7th, April 06-07, 2004, and then in parentheses, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronze, United States Marine Corps. So you click on that page, and then you can click on either map as you're listening to him, and it'll bring a PDF up. And at the bottom of the page, you should see a thing where you could magnify the map and follow along with his kind of narrative of the fight they get into on April 6th and April 7th. And so it's first in a series that we're going to try to do on a weekly basis. Next week, you're going to hear from one of the first platoon commanders that went into Hue City. You've already heard him before, Nick War. We're going to drill down into the fight that he got into as they went into Hue City, designed for anybody, but most importantly for young leaders that can glean the knowledge of how did these guys do it? These guys were new at one time, you know. Hell, you know, 1-5 and 2-5 were breaking out the mount books as they got on trucks and headed towards Hue. They'd been fighting the Viet Cong in the jungle. Right, and in the bushes outside of Da Nang. So anyway, you'll hear Chris Bronze, And Chris and I first met in 2004 in Iraq, in Ramadi. Paul Kennedy was his battalion commander. He's now Major General Kennedy. I met Paul Kennedy at Combat Town at the basic school. I was in charge of it, and out walks his first lieutenant with his hands in his pockets. He walks over to me and he says, are you Captain Mack? And I say, I am. Who are you? He said, I'm Lieutenant Kennedy. I'm out here to help you. I just reported in. I said, well, it's nice to meet you. I said, do you like to teach? Do you like lieutenants? He said, oh, yeah. I said, okay, don't let me catch you being a jackass. And he laughed. He said, you won't. And we've been friends since. We wrote an article together entitled, Why Doesn't First Fire Team Rush? I would recommend it to you. You can find it in the Gazette archives. It's a good article. We've done decision-making stuff together. Anyway, Kennedy's the battalion commander. And Kelly is the assistant division commander. He's going out to take a look at combat outposts. And that's where Chris's company is on the east side of Ramadi. So Kelly says, hey, Mac, you want to go see Kennedy and combat outpost with me? And I said, yeah. So I hop in with Kelly, and we roll across Ramadi to go see Kennedy. And that's where I meet Captain Chris Bronzy. Chris is an outstanding officer. After this deployment, he is nominated and receives the Leftwich Award, which I know he says was earned by his company. But that's the kind of caliber of leader he is. He and I deploy again together in, so we're battle buddies times two, to Afghanistan in 2010-11. And so got a chance to work with him on a regular basis, and just a pro. As solid and good as it gets under pressure, and always looking out for Marines and doing good things. So. I wanted him to do the first one, so that's why it's taken a little bit longer to get this going. So I'm excited that you're going to hear that. So with no time to waste this morning, the United States Marine Corps Band makes it official. Good morning to you. This is dedicated to Billy Graham, who's going to lie in honor to in the Capitol. One of only four Americans to have that honor, or the fourth American to have that honor. Two of them were I believe, Capitol policemen that were shot and killed in the late 90s. The third was Rosa Parks, and he is the fourth. So Reverend Graham, who lived such an exemplary life in an era where a lot of people use televangelism to enrich themselves and subsidize the other things that they did with their life and were ultimately ruined by it. Billy Graham stands probably as an example to all of us about a life better lived. So this is dedicated to him.
We are proud to play the title of the United States of America. just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, a check of the weather. Mostly cloudy in 49 in Quantico, sunny in 55 at Camp Lejeune, clouds in 55 at Granbury, Texas. Montana, sunny in 19, so still cold in the upper plains. 29 Palm Forest warmed up a little bit, partly cloudy in 42 there. Clouds in 46 at Pendleton, Okinawa's warming up, got storms in the vicinity. Dark cloudy in 68 in Okinawa. Marja warms up as well. Dark cloudy in 67 in Afghanistan, in the Helmand Valley of Afghanistan. Currently 46 degrees under partly cloudy skies. Looking up for a high of only 60. Thursday, 61. Friday, 59 with rain. I don't know whose idea this is, but this is ridiculous. All right, let me check a few headlines on a busy morning here. Marine Corps Times, top three stories. Multiple people ill, three taken to hospital after a hazmat incident at Joint Base Myers-Henderson Hall. Evidently, an envelope opened on the Marine side of the base. It was opened, and 11 people started feeling ill after some substance fell out of this envelope. So it was an administrative building in Northern Virginia. For those of you, let's see, Joint Base Fort Myers, right? Henderson Hall, just outside Washington D.C., is the closest installation to the Pentagon. Right, it's the home of the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, the 3rd Infantry Regiment, otherwise known as the Old Guard. Army senior leaders live there, and I believe it's the old Marine Corps, Henderson Hall, the Marine Corps Annex. So that complex right there. So that's in the news. Terrible story that happened, 6 weeks ago? Marine faces murder charges following a fatal school of infantry stabbing. A Marine faces charges of murder and obstruction of justice at a March 6 court-martial following a Camp Pendleton stabbing incident that left one Marine dead. Quote, the charges are the result of an investigation into an incident resulting in the death of a Marine at the School of Infantry, according to Training and Education Command spokesman Captain Joshua Pena. The PFC is accused of violating UCMJ Articles 118, murder, and 134, obstructing justice. These charges are merely an accusation. The Marine is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Blah, 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 blah. PFC Ethan Barclay Weber Powell, 18, died after a stabbing incident January 16th at the School of Infantry West. He was assigned to Lima Company, headquarters and service battalion. SOI West had just entered the Corps in July. Since the incident, the unidentified Marine has been held in confinement at Camp Pendleton. His identity will only be released after the Article 32 hearing. The hearing will provide recommendations on the charges to the convening authority, which is Brigadier General Jason Boehm, who was in the news last week because of saying that IOC standards weren't being watered down. He's a command general of the Marine Corps Training Command. And again, following his arraignment, which is the Article 32 hearing, Boehm will make a decision on whether or not to refer the charges against the Marine, taking into account recommendations from the preliminary hearing officer, blah, 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 blah. First responders found Barclay Weber Powell dead at the scene when reacting to reports of an injured person on January 16th. The body was eventually returned home to his family in Janesville, Wisconsin, buried with full military honors on January 29th. There's a picture of PFC Ethan Barclay Weber Powell with his father in front of the Iwo Jima flag raising, and I'm not exactly sure what location. He shot expert. He's got his National Defense Service ribbons in his dress blue trousers and Charlie's shirt. Good-looking young kid, dead. Top five stories on in the early bird without going into any detail in them. Trump and Boeing reach a handshake agreement to cap Air Force One program at $3.9 billion. Two, the Pentagon probes cost overruns and delays at Stratcom's new $1.3 billion headquarters. Nice. Jared Kushner got his security clearance downgraded from top secret to secret, most of which is in a secret briefing you can find in the pages of your local newspaper. And So that in the news. Four, sweeping legislation aims to fix the U.S. surface Navy. I don't think legislation going to fix it. That's in Defense News. Republican Senators Roger Wicker and John McCain have introduced sweeping legislation that takes aim at the U.S. Navy's readiness and organizational shortfalls that came to light in wake of last year's deadly incidents. It's about leadership, boys. It's about leadership. Okay. There's no reason ships smash into each other. There's no reason you should have a drug ring at your Naval Academy. There's no reason the SEALs should be doing the stupid shit that they do all the time. Okay, but a culture that lacks discipline and lacks leaders obviously is hurting. And then the story, the fifth story is multiple people taken ill at the Joint Base Myers Henderson Hall. So that... Also, aviation pay nearly doubles as the Marine Corps tries to keep qualified pilots. So that is also in the news. Stars and Stripes got a couple interesting headlines. One is a medic has been disciplined after posting a photo of a soldier's severed body part on Snapchat. Like, are you shitting me? Afghan President Ashraf Ghani urges the Taliban on Wednesday to join peace talks aimed at ending the 16-year-old war. And again, you know, you read these stories about, you know, the United States isn't going to win in Afghanistan. The purpose of the uptick in kinetics is to peel the moderate tea from the extreme tea and negotiate a peace, isolate the extreme Taliban. Right? So, just so you have it. All right, now... Without any commercial break, I had Bob Nielsen on for a few minutes yesterday and just wanted to and recorded this as an introduction to Bob DelVecchio. So here you have the one and only Bob Nielsen. All right, on a Wednesday, we continue here on All Marine Radio. And probably a couple weeks ago, Bob Nielsen, the patron saint of All Marine Radio, he sent me a link to a video done by a guy named Bob DelVecchio. And so I wanted to have Mr. Nielsen on and have him talk about the video, and again, we've had a long discussion here on All Marine Radio about the PBS series, and I tried to move the kaleidoscope around for people like me that haven't been there, right, and don't understand the emotions underneath it. I would tell you, I thought on large, it was a fairly balanced presentation, not too skewed to the military, but tried to cover a whole lot of storylines, maybe too many. I've had Vietnam veterans that say, I shut it off, and it was garbage. And so Bob is a Vietnam veteran. So Bob, talk to us about you know, your thoughts on the documentary in general, and then how you came across this Bob DelVecchio video.
Well, I watched Ken Burns' documentary all 12 or 14 sessions of it, just like you, and generally felt it was doing a fair job to a good job of refreshing and reminding a whole lot of people who weren't even born during the Vietnam War what went on. But I listened to a lot of interviews you had with Vietnam veterans that were getting madder and madder because some of the scenes that were in the Ken Burns documentary were the same old crap that we see. You know, we were losing the war after the Tet Offensive. Khe Sanh was a waste of time, and going on and on. And it was frustrating. And I've had a lot of correspondence with buddies of mine that were in Vietnam. And one in particular, a good friend, Jack Farley, he's a retired federal judge. He lost a leg in Vietnam. He was an Army forward observer and lost a leg in a mortar attack. Sent me this copy, YouTube copy of a talk by Robert Del Vecchio that was given, I guess, in Atlanta sometime late last fall after the Burns documentary had been shipped. And I started watching it, and my blood was boiling by the time I got through it, because Del Vecchio went out to point out that so much of what was in the Burns documentary was a repetition of the bullshit that the press has put out again and again and again, like showing a single photograph as if it tells the whole story of a war, but not giving any of the background of the photograph. Both the Vietnamese soldier in Saigon shooting the guy in the head, or the girl running down the street in had been burned by napalm. But when you get the full story of what went on behind it, which has never been told back here, or almost never told, you begin to realize there's a far greater dimension to what went on, and unfortunately, so much baloney has been perpetrated back here. You know, we all think that Cronkite came out and said we're losing the war, when in fact, we were really winning the war at the end of the Tet Offensive. We basically kicked the Viet Cong's ass and North Vietnamese ass and left them in the shambles. But how many people in the press ever say anything about it? So I watched the Del Vecchio and documentary or his speech and said, my God, this has got to be passed around. This has got to be passed out because I know Vietnam veterans want to see this.
All right. And so Del Vecchio is a combat correspondent in Vietnam, Marine type.
Combat Marine photographer.
And so and you'll find pretty interesting in this thing, he sees his images used in that documentary, and he points out the factual errors surrounding them to include they're being used in the wrong years, stuff like that.
Exactly.
And so, but
he was actually, Del Vecchio was wounded, was shot in the hand, so he's been there and done that. But more importantly, I think he said he was a chemist by background. He studied chemistry in college or something. But he's become a historian of what went on in Vietnam and a historian of what the Marine Corps did in Vietnam. And he presents the backside of the moon that so many of us haven't seen or heard. And we got to get that out in public. And I'll tell you, Michael, it continues today. Just yesterday or this weekend, the Sunday Post had a two-page section of photographs about the Tet Offensive and what was going on in Hue. It's all Marines being blasted, wounded, all of this stuff. Not a single peep that we actually kicked the Viet Cong's ass in that battle. Not a mention of it.
No, it's all.
The press continues to do this. They continue to do it.
Yeah, Bob sent me the link, and it's all. The majority of it is either pictures of civilians or Marines wounded during Tet.
And you know they do it in the press because it gets clicks, it gets attention,
right.
But it's not the real story.
Right, and that's
so
what
Del Vecchio has been.
Yeah, Del Vecchio is part of a group of historians that. You know, it's Historians for Truth in Vietnam, and he walks you through these different events. You know, the infamous, you know, police chief shooting the Viet Cong soldier. Viet Cong, he's not a soldier. He's an insurgent in the head. That guy was part of a team that went around and murdered members of the Republic of Vietnam government.
Right, he just murdered several people.
Yeah, they were murdering families and officials. Yeah.
The girl running down the street that had the napalm, she's escaping the village controlled by the North Vietnamese.
Right.
They started a battle there. And you know, it's like every time we celebrate any anniversary or anything of Vietnam, you always end up seeing a picture of Jane Fonda.
Yeah.
Well, let's get the real story out, you know. And so I think DelVecchio has done a hell of a job here in presenting the other side that we all need to know. And I sent it to several friends of mine that were in Vietnam with me. I sent it to a couple of friends of mine from college that went in the military but didn't go to Vietnam, and they couldn't believe it when they saw it because we've all been so brainwashed. And you know, the truth is, when you got back from Vietnam, I got back in 1957, nobody wanted to talk about Vietnam. So for 10 years, everybody swept it under the rug, and the only thing you saw was what Cronkite was saying or what the Post was saying or the New York Times.
You know,
so we've been living on one version, but we haven't been living on the real truth.
All right.
And then don't get me started about McNamara and a few of those characters.
No relation.
No
relation.
No
relation.
No relation.
All right.
No connection whatsoever.
No connection whatsoever. The all right. With that said, I just want to have Bob on to give a brief introduction of what you're about to see here. This is former Marine R.J. DelVecchio, goes by Bob, and his interest in historical accuracy in the Vietnam War on the tail of the Burns Novick PBS documentary, The Vietnam War. Here it is.
Telling the truth, and it's the same story you hear, Mac, when you interview the combat veterans from Vietnam that you talk to.
There you have it. R.J. DelVecchio right here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This presentation was done in front of the Atlanta Vietnam Veterans Business Association. Proud, professional, and patriotic. It was done on February 6th of 2018. The title of it is Correcting the Myths of the Vietnam War. So, with that said, here is R.J. DelVecchio, Marine, and Speaker of the Truth.
He joined the Marines because all the other services wanted to make use of him as a chemist. That means that the Army lost out. But the Marines didn't make him a chemist. They made him a combat photographer. After a year working in the States at Quantico Marine Base, he got transferred to Vietnam and joined the 1st Marine Division, Photo Lab. And from the Photo Lab, he started going to the field as a combat photographer. In May of 68, which is why we should be careful saying nobody gets wounded but grunts, working as a combat photographer, bullets smashed through one hand into his camera. He caught the worst end. He recovered at a field hospital, went back to his unit, and served up until November, where he returned to the continental U.S. and went into business as an industrial chemist. After decades in corporate work, he became an independent consultant in 1990 and has been in that practice since. He became very active in veteran-related matters and believed that a lot of the correct telling of the Vietnam War was being sealed away. He's been deeply involved in studying and discussing the Vietnam War's history for the past 20 years. He also co-authored an introductory booklet for students of the war called Whitewash, Blackwash, Myths of the Vietnam War. He believes strongly in the need to correct the largely inaccurate and often falsely reported history of that war, as a duty to the nation and its history and to the memories of all who served. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker today, DelVecchio. Thank you very much for joining us.
ladies, gentlemen, and everybody else. It's interesting. We used to talk about, make jokes about how old we were. You know, I remember this. I'm older than dirt. I'm so old that I remember when the concept and term of honor had meaning for most Americans. I'm not sure that's true anymore. But I know what it means. So when I say to you that I am deeply honored to be here to talk to this group, it's not a minor figure of speech. It's really something. So we're going to start from there. A quick, funny thing. I joined the Marines because I didn't want to become a limited duty officer to stay in the United States. And in the formation, after basic training, you're standing there and they're handing out MOS numbers. And in the Marine Corps, 0311 was a rifleman, 0331 machine gunner, 08 was artillery. We had all these numbers memorized. So they're going down the line, you know, Smith, 0311, Jones, 0311, Dixon, 0826, Delvecchio, 4631. To which I said, huh? And I walked to the gunny after and said, gunny, what's it? I don't know, Marine, let's look it up. Says here you're going to be a photographer. To which I said, huh? And I ended up at the Quantico Photo Lab. Three other guys were standing there waiting to get processed. We started talking. We've all studied some chemistry. We realized that some clerk in the third sub-basement of Marine Corps headquarters said, hey, Joe, they need guys at photo school. They do chemicals there, don't they? Look up all the guys who got chemistry. Send them to photo school. And at the time, I was very upset about it. It wasn't what I wanted to do. I think everybody in this room is mature enough to know that sometimes things happen in life that you think are great, and later on they're not so great, you know, like your first wife. But sometimes things happen that you think are not so great, and they are great. And in a sense, it was divine providence that told me to be a photographer, because I got to experience the war in a very different and special way than most people have, for which I'm very grateful. And by the way, that comment about who gets shot, 12 of my friends of other combat photographers died in Vietnam. Of the rest of us, more than half were wounded more than once, because in those days, if you were going to do the job, you went up front to do it. And if you went up front, things were a little picky sometimes. One of our members was the recipient of the Medal of Honor. He was in a bomb crater with a bunch of other people, and in a bad firefight, and a grenade was thrown in, and he did what people do sometimes. It's the hard way to get the Medal of Honor, but that's what he did. Anyhow, the bottom line is that years ago, I got contacted on the email by a Marine who said, are you the guy who took this picture back in May 68? And the answer was yes. He said, we want you to come to our reunions. And I have been invited by several Marine units to their reunions. And as most of you know, the grunts are the tightest fraternity there is. And there is no greater honor in my life that they invite me to be with them. And the honor is also to be here. All that being said, one last thing. We have a Vietnamese guest here to whom I would like to say Chúc Mừng Năm Mới, which is Happy New Year. The other Vietnamese phrase that I know, Chúng ta đã chiến đấu cho tu gió, cho tu gió. And I know you all know what that means. Chúng ta is Vietnamese for we, a special we. Da chiến đấu, cho chiến đấu means we fought. Cho for, we fought for. Tu gió. What is tu gió? Tu gió is that thing that people have fought and struggled and strived and suffered for and died for throughout history and still do today. It means freedom. And I addressed that to my Vietnamese friends, but to everyone here. Why do we go to Vietnam? Oh, so we could take over from the French and the oppressors. No. So we could steal the oil and the coconuts and the rice or whatever. No. So that other people can make a lot of money from the war. No. We went because President Kennedy said we would fight every foe and bear every burden for the sake of liberty. Not just for ourselves, but for others. That's why we went. And nowadays, sometimes I think we have to remind people of that. There's still a vein of people who have very negative views of the war. And my bottom line is, regardless of how badly we were led at times, how restricted we were in fighting, how badly we were treated when we came home, and how what we fought for was thrown away by people in Congress, we do not owe anyone an ounce of apology. All right, all that said, let me bring you back a little bit, and I'm sorry to do this at lunchtime, but I think this might set the tone. You're going to have a two-minute recording made in March of 1968 with the 5th Marines, and they were on a sweep, and they met some other people. Can you play the clip, please?
M79.
No, baby.
Go blue for baby. Left basket shot after calling. The blood.
And you can hear the enthusiasm. Get some. Old Marine comes in. Now that we've gone through that, we can start with an easier part of this. If we can. It says right here. September 1968, China Beach. That's when I had more hair and fewer pounds. But I'm still glad to be here at all. You can see there that I was originally a still photographer, but the other guys who were most picture photographers got killed, so they decided that I would become a motion picture photographer. If any of you managed to sit all the way through the Burns series, in episode 7, 29 minutes into it, they're talking about Paul Vallely getting a medal for an operation in 1969, and they show a long series of a firefight. And I looked at it and said, that's really nice, but that firefight was in 1968. I know, because I took those pictures. And by the way, what got me about selective editing was at the end of that, they briefly showed the picture of a Vietnamese boy about 12 years old lying dead on the ground. I took that picture. What they didn't show were the three dead NVA around him. They had impressed him from the village and taken him with them into a Marine ambush, which, of course, in the dark, everybody gets killed. But they don't tell you that. They just show you this dead Vietnamese boy that we must be responsible for. They don't mention the three NVA who took him from his village and got him killed. That's the kind of thing that we object to about the Burns series. It's not there's so much in there that's false, or there is some false stuff. There's so much that's left out. It's like the iceberg where they show you the top and they kind of miss a lot of the rest of it. Oops, let's see. Where do I put this thing? No, wrong thing. There we go. Just quick background. You've already heard this stuff. I didn't mention, growing up, I knew Polish refugees, Hungarian refugees, later on Cuban refugees. I heard about their escaping, their life under communism. And there wasn't much doubt in my mind that communism was really a pretty bad thing. And we didn't want to let it keep growing and taking over more of the world and maybe coming to our shores someday. That's why I was in graduate school in St. Louis. I was been studying the war. I wound up, I know this is hard to believe, having arguments with people in school about the war because it was already anti-war sentiment in the schools back in those days. And by then, a couple of my classmates had been killed already who were Razi people. And there's more than one way to be a good citizen in this country, no question about that. But one of the ways to be a good citizen is to join the military and answer your country's call. So, and after arguing with all these stupid kids, I decided that I would put my money where my mouth is, or my butt where my mouth was, so to speak, and join up. And that's the whole thing I went through. Got to be a combat photographer. Many years later, I came back from the war and saw some anti-war demonstrations. I saw how things were going. And by 71, I really thought we're gonna bow out of this. We're gonna abandon these people. And when Saigon fell for me, it was like, yeah, what else is new? It was coming the whole time. And that hurt. That hurt a lot. And like many of us, I put the war in the back of my head and I closed the door and I hammered some beams across the door and I didn't think about it as much as I could avoid it for the next 20 years. And then one day I was teaching a high school class and the subject of war and killing came up and I brought up the subject. I showed some of my pictures to the kids. And on the way home, my son, who was then 17, said, "Dad, I've been with you my whole life and you never said a word about any of this." And I think that's probably true of a lot of us, that we don't talk to other people about it. There's a reason veterans don't talk to other people about it. Partially, when we came back, nobody wanted to hear about it. That wasn't very good. And secondarily, a lot of us realized that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to communicate to others what war is like, what it's about. It's something that you really can't get across very well, and sometimes it's easier to just shut up and go on with your life. So we did. But I got involved more and more, and now I've been sucked all the way into it because it terrifies me. There's a famous saying that if you don't learn the lessons of war, you're bound to repeat them. Well, you only learn the lessons of the history of war if you actually study the real history. If you study the wrong history, you get the wrong lessons. And that's what's been happening with Vietnam for a long time. I say to people that the major domestic casualties of the Vietnam War were academia and our media. They took a sharp left turn by the end of the war, and they have never come back, to the best of my knowledge. Okay. So that's what that's about. I joined a group years ago. We started up called Vietnam Veterans for Factual History. There's a bunch of veterans, historians, very qualified people who are. We've got a website in which we try to put only very factual stuff. Somebody famous once said, "Everybody has a right to their own set of opinions," and that's true. Nobody has a right to their own set of facts, And a lot of people quote facts about Vietnam that, oddly enough, aren't quite facts. But they use them and they believe them. What about the series? Mr. Burns is a very famous documentarian. He's done very interesting work in the past, fascinated a lot of people. Although I do know a few Southerners who aren't entirely enthusiastic about his series on the Civil War. Hard to believe. Or as some call it, the Northern Invasion. Real reporting is objective and thorough. You go into reporting looking for facts, looking for what happened. And only after you put all that together, you start thinking about the analysis and what it means. You don't go into it with your mind made up already about what it means. When bias creeps in, there's a problem. And the more skillful a presenter you are, I work in my profession as an expert witness sometimes, and I have seen it proven that the right smart guy can prove to you that the sun rises in the west. And you'll walk out of the room thinking, damn, all this time, I thought it came up in the east, you know. Depending on somebody's powers of presentation, they can be very convincing in a lot of ways. And you walk out thinking, this is great. Burns declared in an interview early on, it was obvious we shouldn't be there. Oh, that's not a bias of any sort, is it? He later explained his purpose was to produce an emotional reality. And Lynn Novick has also basically said, don't bug us with details, we were creating something. That's really nice. That's not exactly rigorous history. What's wrong here? What can we find? How about the few things that are simply incorrect? They referred very early on to the cancellation of promised elections. And a lot of the anti-war literature is full of the fact that we reneged on a promise to have free elections, and that caused everything to go bad. You can download a copy of the Geneva Accords from the Internet anytime you want and go over it. It says in there in a couple of places that elections should be held later. It was signed by a French general and a representative of the Viet Minh. It was between France and the Viet Minh. The United States didn't sign it. South Vietnam did not sign it. Nobody else signed it. It was not binding on anybody except France and the Viet Minh about their ceasefire and dividing the country. There was a secondary document called the Final Declaration, which did call for elections. Free elections supervised by the United Nations. Nobody signed that. Ho Chi Minh was not about to sign anything about supervised elections. Every election that was ever held, he got 99.91% of the vote. Never saw that before in a communist country. For anybody to have gone ahead with elections when the population of North Vietnam was larger than the population of South Vietnam was suicide for South Vietnam. The United States didn't cancel any elections. They were never scheduled. They were never committed to. And Ho Chi Minh, if anybody didn't want elections, it was Ho Chi Minh. He was not about to have them supervised. In the series, at one point, a woman named Mai Elliott. Now, by the way, there are, to the best of my knowledge, about 200,000 to 300,000, probably closer to 300,000, Vietnamese refugees living in Southern California who came over as adults, who fought, who lived, who suffered through everything there, 99.9% of which have very strong opinions against anti-communism and for RVN. And somehow, Mr. Burns could only find Mai Elliott and one other guy who are Vietnamese refugees who despise the Saigon government, despise the ARVN, and despise the American attempt to aid. Gee, that's really odd somehow. But no bias. I'm sorry, what Mai Elliott said at one point in her interview was that Of course the war was going to go badly because nothing ever changed. There was always stupid people doing stupid things, and there was always all this resistance. 50 years ago today, people would be taken out of their homes in Hue and shot on the street. By the end of February, over 5,000 people had been taken out. The lucky ones were shot. Many were beaten to death. And in their particularly nice way of killing people, they were buried alive. If you bury someone alive, it takes about 2 minutes to choke slowly to death on the dirt in your nose and mouth. It's a very unpleasant way to die. And they killed a lot of people that way. What happened after Tet was that everything in South Vietnam changed. All the people who had ever been on the fence about the communists came off the fence. Simple fact. After Tet 68, how many Buddhist monks burned themselves to death again? Zero. All the Buddhist resistance stopped. Because everybody said, wait a second, these guys are really bad news. They didn't have to draft people for the Arvin the rest of 68 because so many young men joined. Everything changed because of Tet 68. But she says nothing changed. Nah, not exactly. Oh, sorry. And the other big thing they keep mentioning Ho is, of course, the nationalist. And I recently saw somebody commenting about, well, he was a nationalist communist. You're a nationalist or you're a communist. What was Ho? Let me think. He wrote enthusiastic pans of praise upon reading Lenin's summaries of how to run a revolution. He was a founder in Paris of the French Communist Party. He lived in Russia for years and attended the Lenin Institute to become an agent of the Comintern and spent over 25 years in Asia organizing communist groups in China and elsewhere. When he set up finally camp in Vietnam, he named the camp and the stream nearby Marx and Lenin. When he was dying, he said he was looking forward in the next life to meeting the important people of the world. Not Phan Bo Choi or the Trung sisters or any of the famous Vietnamese patriots. He was looking forward to meeting Lenin and Marx. But he wasn't a communist, really. Crazy stuff that just goes on. Things they left out. One of the big ones. A lot of coverage of the shot of General Luan shooting Hup Luck in the head. Really nice. Lots of coverage. Very brutal. Very nasty. That's the top of the iceberg. What's the rest of the iceberg? Some of you were at a conference recently in which a professor stood up and said, well, he really was an innocent civilian they just picked up. Okay, I did the research. He's buried in a communist graveyard outside Saigon with a note on a tombstone of the day he died as a hero of the revolution. His wife identified him as being a VC agent. Okay, don't believe us, believe the communists. Okay? He was involved with the hit squads that they had in Saigon, the same way they had them in Hue, in which they went around killing police and national policemen and officers. And people argue about which one of the families exactly they're sure he slaughtered, but they know he was involved in slaughtering the families. So this guy was a flat-out murderer, out of uniform. The Geneva Conventions basically say, if you're out of uniform and you murder people, that's a war crime and you are subject to execution. General Luan was in the middle of a battle. There were bullets flying. They were still fighting in Chulan. And he shot the guy in the head. Unfortunately, the picture was taken. And it ruined Luan's life. But that's the real background that they didn't bother to cover. I think it's kind of important to cover that. I really do. Morley Safer made a famous broadcast of Marines lighting some hooches on fire. And it was reported in this country as, you know, my God, we're burning peasants out of their homes. I know Marines who were there. If Morley Safer had crossed the street in front of them, he never would have made it to the other side. They were asked by the local Army commander to check out the village, which was VC sympathetic. On the way to the village, they were fired on. Four Marines were wounded. They fired back. The snipers left. The Arvin officer who was their accompanying officer from the South Vietnamese military said, our policy is if somebody shoots at us from a house, we burn the house down. Please go burn the house down. Morley Safer gave one of the guys his Zippo to help him light the house. Did he mention any of that in the report? No, didn't mention any of that in the report. Why would you bother? If you watch the series, there was a lot of discussion with the 20 out of 29 Vietnamese interviewed who were members of the VC or the NVA. 20 out of 29. And the other two were the ones who didn't like the South anyhow. If that's balanced reporting, I can put a Yorkie on one end of the seesaw and a St. Bernard on the other. It'll be perfectly level. Don't worry about it. Okay. In fact, what got me was they had, if you watch it, one guy admitted how much fun it was for him and his friends to take a guy out of the village they didn't like and chop him to death with machetes out in the field. And that was okay. It's like, really? Okay, that's okay. By the way, let me say this. There's a lot of stuff in the series that's good information. They did a lot of good research. But it's like somebody said, it's like you make a great cake, and when you make it, you scatter in it a bunch of small pebbles. So you enjoy the cake, and then you break a tooth. And for me, watching the series was like, here's some good stuff, and then a tooth breaks because of the kind of stuff they put in there. And they didn't mention much of anything about how brave and dedicated the Arvin were. A lot of people have retained a very poor opinion of the Arvin because from about 60 through 65, 66, their units were about 20% good, about 40% mediocre, and about 40% terrible. And people had a memories of when they were bad. What people don't understand, especially those of us who left, was that they started getting better in 67. And they got a lot better with Vietnamization. In Eastern Invasion, when the VC were gone, there was a Rommel-style invasion of South Vietnam. 200,000 men, 400 tanks, several hundred pieces of Russian artillery, better than anything we left the Vietnamese. Hundreds and hundreds of anti-aircraft guns came storming in, like Rommel into France, and we weren't there anymore. And they were stopped in battles bigger than we were in by who? Oh, by the Arvin. And most people understand they got much, much better. By that time, their units were basically like 50% really good, 30% pretty good, and 20% mediocre. By that time, the South Vietnamese government had distributed several hundred thousand small arms to the regional and popular forces. Everybody keeps saying, well, there's all this communist support. Wait a second. The region of popular forces were armed by the government, and they were fighting off what was left of the VC. Everything had changed. And most people don't understand that. Okay? I have friends who, Bill Laurie was there till the end as an advisor, who was in the middle of all this. And they said, yeah, everything was totally different. My cousin John, who wrote a book called The 13th Valley, was there in 71. They had to turn their weapons in when they went into a city. They weren't doing that when I was there, okay? You could drive Route 1 from the DMZ to the Delta. It was all safe. The cities were all safe. Everything had changed. And most of us aren't fully aware of how much things had changed. The war, in a way, was essentially won by 72. Of course, there was a detail that we promised to keep supplying them, and that didn't exactly work out. The supplies got cut way back. I knew a guy who was died a few years ago. He lived his whole life there. He'd been in the Viet Minh, fought the French, but then he joined the South. He was the commander of a depot for tanks, and he said by 73 I would have to cannibalize three tanks to get one to go out because we weren't getting spare parts. And when the tank went out, it would have three rounds for the main gun and two boxes of 50. That was all they could give it. They were starving out there, okay? Meanwhile, here's a fact most people don't know. Who spent more money on Vietnam, us or Russia? Russia. Russia shipped over 5,000 trucks to North Vietnam. Over 1,200 tanks. Hundreds and hundreds of artillery pieces, again, better than we had. Thousands of anti-aircraft guns. They broke their bank with all those missiles. All those SAMs are very expensive, okay? They shipped in oceans of fuel, mountains of ammunition. You know, they just spent like crazy, which is part of why they went bankrupt in the long run, between that and Afghanistan. But if you have two fighters who are going to go into the ring and fight, and one guy gets half a bowl of rice every day for a few months, and the other guy gets all the food he needs for a few months, when they go into the ring, who's more liable to win? Maybe the guy who's been fed properly.
You're listening to Bob Delvecchio. He is a former Marine cameraman and served in Vietnam. And he did this presentation to the Atlanta Vietnam Veterans Business Association on February 6, 2018. It is his criticism, firsthand in some cases, about what the Ken Burns documentary got wrong in terms of factual presentations. And then in others, his criticism is they use an image and they don't tell. He consistently uses this iceberg example where the image only tells part of the story. And he's used a very famous video and still image of the execution that happened in Saigon and tells the whole story. That guy was an executioner. The guy that got shot in the head, he was executing South Vietnamese government officials and their families. He's not in a uniform. He's not entitled to any protection under the Geneva Convention. He's a murderer, and he was executed. It's not the story that got to the American people. So this is the angst. This is the hate that wells up inside Vietnam veterans when they see the story of their conflict being partially told. So you're listening to former Marine R.J. Delvecchio. We'll get him on the program here at some point in the not-too-distant future. But this is an incredible presentation. And after this, in about 30 minutes, you'll hear our first battlefield study done with Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronzy. And you'll hear the story of Golf Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines in Ramadi in Iraq on April 6th and 7th of 2004. So sit back, relax, enjoy the morning. R.J. Delvecchio, Bob Delvecchio, it's awesome.
The end of South Vietnam was inevitable. We starved them. The Russians fed the side. As Louis Sorley has said, sadly, Russia proved to be much better ally to the north than we were to the south in the end. By the way, anti-war people, there's a lot of coverage of how wonderful and sincere they all were. I know a bunch of anti-war people who were very nice people, very sincere. I knew Quakers that I swear to God, if you were going to kill their children in front of them, they'd still pray for you. I'm not quite that nice. Actually, not close. Threaten my children, and I hope your life insurance is paid up. But, you know, they neglect the detail that the people at the top of the anti-war movement, they weren't about anti-war, saving American lives. They were about wanting a communist victory. They weren't anti-war. They were pro-Hanoi, okay? Tom Hayden went to Paris to get his commands from Madame, I forget her right name, the Vietnamese woman represented from the NLF, and came back and said so. We're getting our directions from the NLF. Oh, really? Great. Even in the Burns thing, if you look in the background of the protests, you'll see Viet Cong flags flying. That's not anti-war. We want to save lives. That's why. That's we know who we want to win, and we want America out of there so they can win. Very big difference. And maybe the really nasty anti-war people were a fraction of those in the anti-war movement. I probably think they were, but they were the top fraction running things, and that's what was really significant. Omissions. Well, okay, we covered My Lai again and again, and depth and depth and depth and depth. And there was no excuse. It is and remains a shame. And there were a couple of other things. I've done the research. A couple of other times when our people did not do very well, and they were shames, okay? They were aberrations. They were violations of policy. They were not who we were. But the policies of the communists were who they were. They came away with lists of people to kill, and Saigon as well. They were big on terrorism. But we don't get a lot of detail in any of that. They just kind of slide past that. That's not to say that because they were bad, we're excused. We're not going to say that. What we're going to say is there's an enormous difference between the occasional deviation into being bad and a consistent policy of evil actions. I mean, if you got to decide, put it this way, when the final invasion came, how many people were running towards the communists? No, they were running away from them because they were so terrified of them, and with good reason. Tragedy at Kent State, also a mess. They never mentioned the fact that we have since found out there were several pistol shots going on just before the National Guard opened fire, which many people believe is what occasioned that firing to start. Doesn't make it any less of a tragedy, but it's not like it was presented to be sometimes as a bunch of National Guardsmen just going crazy and shooting kids for the hell of it. The Eastern invasion is mentioned, but they don't mention the size of it, the extent of it, and what it meant. What it meant was that, in a sense, we did not fight a war in Vietnam. If we fought a war in Vietnam, we would have bombed a lot more of North Vietnam. We would have mined Haiphong Harbor. We would have blown up the railways into China. We would have had hot pursuit in the Laos and Cambodia. We would not have fooled around. We would have had a landing in North Vietnam like we had in China and North Korea. We didn't do any of that. We essentially fought a holding action from 1965 to 1971, so the Vietnamese could take care of themselves. And by the Eastern invasion, they demonstrated that supplied, they could take care of themselves. But you didn't hear that in the series either. Lam Son, presented as a big disaster. Well, it was a mess, but they went into a group that was totally ready for them. They still killed more of the communists than they killed themselves, but it wasn't quite the disaster as presented. It didn't go as well as it could have, but it wasn't. It's presented as being, well, that, see, these guys could never fight. They did fight. They did a fairly good job considering that they were outnumbered about 3-1 going into a major ambush. Okay, it's their security wasn't as good as it should have been. The NVA knew they were coming. We didn't do that well in some of our invasions of World War II either. There's always the bridge too far if you want to think about it. Oh, the other famous picture from the war, the naked girl running down the highway burned by napalm. Well, they showed that thing. They do admit that it wasn't an American plane that dropped the napalm, which is nice that they finally got around to mentioning that. They didn't really mention that the only reason that happened was because the NVA had invaded that village. You know, if you're the guy who does the invading, then you're the guy who's responsible for what happens. So the responsibility for everything that happened in that village is responsible to the NVA because they're the guys who invaded the village. Okay? They didn't mention that she was medevaced by Americans, spent a lot of time in hospitals there, was fixed up a whole lot better, and was able to go back to her village with her family. There's a book called The Girl in the Picture that is a great book because in passing, it mentions what life was like for them after the communists took over and how everything went to hell for their whole family because of the communists taking over, even though she's supposed to be a hero. She wanted to be a doctor. They wanted to make her a propaganda subject. They don't mention that, gee whiz, after years of being denied what she wanted to do, she and her husband managed to inveigle their way on a flight to go to Russia that stopped by in Canada on the way back. And when it stopped by in Canada, she and her husband got off and defected and live in Canada. Because as privileged as they were, they wanted tuzioi. They wanted freedom as well. And that's where they live today. Did they mention that? I don't remember them mentioning that. The convoy of tears. They deliberately shelled huge columns of people. The death toll is in the tens of thousands, and that wasn't covered very well either. And they deliberately shelled those columns. More people died from those columns being shelled than anywhere else in any of the atrocities. And they didn't mention that very much either. Over the years, over 40,000 people were assassinated, kidnapped, and never seen again. Later examination of VC documents, it says, if you're going to kill someone who's popular in the village, don't kill them there, because that might upset people. Take them into the jungle and kill and bury them there so nobody will know what happened to them. Of the 40,000 people, the ones that were kidnapped, nobody ever came back. So it's kind of like, yeah, I don't think they made it. They don't mention that. They don't mention how terrible it was. There's a book by a German reporter who had no axe to grind and talks about the atrocities he saw that I will not go into here, but they're horrendous atrocities that they did very, very deliberately. And that was part of their policy. And there wasn't much dwelling on that. Lots of discussions of what was wrong with the Saigon government. The Saigon government was not perfect. On the other hand, there were something like 18 opposition of newspapers freely published in Saigon, many of which were very critical of the government. The day after April 30, the next day, how many of those newspapers were publishing? None. None ever. The only papers that get published after that were the official papers of the Communist Party. But hey, we're told that the victory of the Communists brought, I always remember this phrase, liberation and justice to South Vietnam. My definition of liberation and justice is just a little different than what they seem to be using. The biggest omission of all, never mentioned at all. What happened after the victory? What liberation and justice? Well, let's see. People argue if there were as few as 40,000 executions or as many as 70. Well, you can argue with that, but that's tens of thousands of people. About 1.3 million went into re-education, some for short time, some for 18 years. Death rate for the long-term prisoners was very high, about 30%. The father of a friend of mine died there. It's funny because if you overwork people, beat the crap out of them, don't feed them, they have no medical care, oddly enough, some of them get sick and die. Actually, the cute part was not all died in the camps. They had a little policy. If you were about ready to die, they would release you so you could go home and die. All civil liberties were gone. They have this charter that says that they have liberties, like religious liberty. But under the communist government, religious liberty is so important. It's so important that we're going to help you with your religion. A simple example, we're going to decide for the Catholics, whom they really hate, who can be ordained a priest. Because you have to meet certain criteria so that we know that you'll be a good priest. And ordinations in South Vietnam went from 400 a year to 4. And after a number of years, what people started doing was saying, well, we're going to send our seminary students to Rome. And they send them to Rome where they get ordained in Rome and then come back. They suppressed the Cao Dai, the Wao Hao. I've been at a Cao Dai temple talking about it. It's all under, we're helping you. But it's all control, control, control. And they originally, from 75 to 85, they had Marxist economics, which meant everybody started starving. And only when in 85, when the Russian aid stopped, did they have to change. And, oh, by the way, they had this relentless indoctrination. This starts in grade school. When you go to Vietnam, which is a wonderful country to visit as a tourist, by the way, especially the South, they really like America. It's very friendly. And if you adapt to their food, which I have, I love their food. It's very, very nice in a lot of ways. Beautiful place, friendly people, very little crime. But you'll see all these kids going to school, and they all have these little pretty red scarves on. Isn't that nice? Why do they have to put a little red scarf on? because if you don't have a red communist scarf on, you don't go to school. Very simple. And if you're going to go to college, you will join the Young Communist League or you won't be going to college. That is, if you're allowed to go to college, because, by the way, everybody who worked for Republic of Vietnam in any way, shape, or form, Arvin, postal clerk, doesn't matter. You, your children, and your grandchildren have your internal passports marked, and you have special discrimination. You cannot hold certain jobs. You cannot live in certain places. You're denied more educational benefits. It is a three-generation punishment for ever having been part of any opposition to the Communist Party. And children go to school where they are basically indoctrinated that essentially Ho Chi Minh is a combination of George Washington and Jesus Christ. And I got to tell you, brainwashing works. It doesn't work on everybody, but the people it doesn't work on, they learn to just shut up. Over there, if you raise your head up, you look like a nail. And they have a hammer. So you just learn to shut up. Just last month, a young blogger exposed massive pollution by a Chinese company that was allowed to do it because they bribed somebody. He is now the guest of the state for the next 7 years. If you go to trial by the state in Vietnam, this is a formality. Going to trial means you're going to jail. We're just going to go through this little show first, okay? And they have lots of charges like insulting the national prestige, undercutting the party's authority. You know, it doesn't matter what the words are. I was busted in Hue 2 years ago by the cops for the crime of giving money to people they don't like. And it turns out that if you're high enough up, I was busted by the chief of the state police, who told me he had been waiting for 3 years for me to come to his jurisdiction. He hated me. He hates the people I help. He hates the charity I run. And he knew I hadn't come to Vietnam for years because I had been sick in the United States. Nice that they were watching out for me. It's good to have friends. But, yeah, and he basically said, you know, get out of town. Don't ever come back. And the seven crippled men I had had lunch with the day before, who between the seven of them had three legs, they were short two or three arms and two or three eyes. He had busted all of them right after the lunch, kept them, harassed them, threatened them, told me about it with glee the next day. For the first time since 1968, I actually had the strong urge to kill someone. But I promised my wife that morning that I would be Robert De Niro. I would play an actor. I just played, I'm a dumb American giving money to poor people. What do I know? He knew I was lying, but it didn't matter. And I just played that role, and they finally said, get out of town, don't ever come back. And I can't go back anymore. I'm part of a charity called Vietnam Healing Foundation. We've got some stuff in the back if you care to look at it. And by the way, we're one of those charities that we don't give out 5% of the money. Our overhead is 5%. Nobody gets paid anything. We give all the money to people who need it. We've been going back for years, and we have to be an underground charity. If we were giving money to orphanages, they wouldn't bother us, but we're giving money to crippled old Arvin veterans, and they don't want them to get any help. That's how crazy it is. I want to go to Hanoi and scream at somebody. It's 50 years. You won. Come on. Back off this stuff. But that's how they are. Anyhow, that's the stuff that goes on, and they didn't cover any of that. And the funny part is, the name of Vietnam is, the formal name is the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. Anybody here study political science? In true socialism, the government is responsible for your house, your job, your education, and your medical care. You get all those coming to you. In Vietnam, you get... Actually, you kind of get, never mind. You don't get that, okay? You don't get any of that. It's not remotely socialist. We have far more socialism here in this country than they have in Vietnam. That's the strange thing, okay? They have crony capitalism like China does, except it's very, very corrupt. And you talk about a distribution of wealth. The people at the top are incredibly wealthy. The kids of high party members drive Mercedes, which cost $100,000 in Vietnam, when the average Vietnamese family will struggle for a long time to spend $2,000 to buy a motorbike. It's not remotely Marxist or anything like it. It's essentially governed by the mafia, and they get away with it. But we're back on liberation and justice. What bias? Okay, the two major advisors to Mr. Burns, McPeak and Vallelet. Nice guys, both veterans. Both charter members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. If that's who your chief advisors are, maybe there might be a slant to this. 29 Venus interviewed, 20 VCNVA, 31 Vets interviewed, 11 anti-war. They didn't interview Kissinger, Moyar, Turner, great professors. They interviewed Bob Sorley. After 2 hours of Lynn Novick screaming at him, he was giving me the wrong answers. He got up and left. But they put him on the show briefly, very briefly. He's still bitter about that. Very nice professional presentation, not objective history. That's what we have to say about it. It's very frustrating because it could have been. It could have been a great presentation. But it's that cake with the pebbles in it. And the sad part is, I know some very nice people who watched it and said, wow, it's great history. Now we know all about the war. And I just wince, and I have to try to break the news to them that they don't really. A few pictures. This is me going out almost 50 years ago. That was about February 14th into from Hill 10 to go hunting the V.C. This picture is fairly famous in a number of documentaries. That is a corpsman there, a corpsman here. They're working on a guy with a sucking chest wound. We're in triple canopy. We can hear the chopper overhead. We can hear the chopper trying to drop the armored thing. Get hung up in the trees 4 times. The 4th time, they came under a machine gun guy from the NVA, and they left, and the guy died. Not one of our better days. That's just an evacuation off a mountaintop. This is, some of you may recognize this, going into an operation. This is my mind-reading shot. I got off the chopper to take pictures of the guy being evacuated. He's looking at me. I can read his mind. He's saying, who is this person with an unnaturally close relationship with his maternal parent who's got a camera? This is burning a hooch out in the villages where when we came across abandoned hooches in the village, in the boondocks, we burned them down. You deny resources to the enemy. This is a famous picture. I've got some copies of it back there. This is a machine gun team that same day that the movies were taken. And this is where I was criticized by somebody saying, my camera angle is too low to the ground. You understand. It's funny about those sharp snapping noises going by your head, you know, kind of gets your attention. This is just, you get so filthy, and there's one of the good moments when there's nobody shooting at you. Half the guys, oh, women, if there's any ladies in the audience, don't look, there's naked men, sorry. This is at Hue. I didn't take this picture, and you'll see this up here. Dick Van, propaganda. Somebody could translate that for me, but what it says in Vietnamese is it's telling the people to rise against the puppets of T and Q. Propaganda was as important to their war effort as the military was, and to show you how thorough they were, they put it in English as well. And in a sense, that's what brought them victory. This is a picture, 7 May 68, bad, bad ambush in deep jungle. You can see the trees are chopped down. The tank commander jumped up. He was under 50, got shot in the head. The next guy jumped up, got shot. They kept going. There's a machine gun nest right here. This is a squad leader. He's putting down suppressive fire. This is the assault. These two guys with their arms back, they're walking forward, firing semi-automatic, bang, 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 to keep the head down of the machine gunner. The guy with his two elbows in back, why are his elbows in back? Because his hands are in front like this. He's pulling the pin. Those guys worked together for a long time. It was like watching an NBA team going up for a lineup. They went in and took out the machine gun nest and just kept on going. This was the best combat sequence I got. After that, I changed film in the camera, and then a bullet went through it shortly after that. This is just for those who might remember the lovely fun of walking through elephant grass. The first time nobody warned me. And I had my sleeves up. The next thing, my arms were running blood because it just cuts the pieces out of you. It's really great. This is a motto which I see that you've got in the back somewhere. The helmet liners with the graffiti from Vietnam. I was a smartass. I had Latin on mine. And these are Vietnamese kids. And I'm going to go quickly. this is what also went on in the field. And this is who we were in the villages. We'd get to a village, we'd secure it, and the corpsman would have sick call for all the Vietnamese. And 10 years ago, I was at a reunion. I had this picture up. A guy came up and rolled his sleeve up and showed me this tattoo. Same guy, 30 years later. He lives outside Asheville. The corpsman had taken care of this little boy. This is his grandmother. I didn't know they grew popcorn in Vietnam, but they do. She took this gourmet cooking pot and used sand as a medium, cooked popcorn, and then lit her cheroot, by the way. And the Marines sat around with the kids eating popcorn. You want to talk about a surreal movement? But that's who we were in the villages, okay? And this is my favorite picture of any I ever took. We were in a small village one night. There were like 40 people there, women, children, old men. They didn't have much food. They had some rice. We held the rice. We opened up and gave her a bunch of cans of sea ration meat. She made a dish of meat and rice, which in their starved diet was like Thanksgiving dinner. And you can see she's in rags. She's poor. But she's fed her father and her kids with that meat and rice. And I happen to snap this picture. And it's my favorite picture because that's who we were. We weren't the monsters. That's who we were. And that's my last picture there, which I originally thought I could fool the Vietnamese and say that was anybody, but my Vietnamese friends say, no, we can see the nose. We know it's an American. And it says down here what it says up there. That's it. I'm open for all kinds of questions. I'll be around if anybody wants to talk to me. I'll be happy to talk to anybody at any time. Thank you very much.
R.J. DelVecchio, thoughts on the Ken Burns series. Incomplete. Or as he says, it's like a great cake that they threw a bunch of pebbles in. And you eat some cake, and then your tooth hits a pebble. And you deal with that. So we've talked about the Vietnam series and the criticisms of it. And so I thought Bob Nielsen sent that to me, and I think it's important that that documentary be appropriately footnoted, and then when we watch it and when people bring it up, introduce them to people like Bob DelVecchio and say, yeah, you know, there was good stuff in that. But there were huge gaps where it was inaccurate. And if you're interested, I'd really have a YouTube video that you could watch that will paint a more complete picture of it. Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the inaugural edition of Battlefield Studies here on All Marine Radio. You're going to meet Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronzy, a battle buddy times two of mine, and very proud to do this. And we're also, I believe on Friday, you'll hear the inaugural version of our series dedicated to NCOs, NCO leadership. I don't know what we're going to call it. We'll pick some cool name for it. But and Mike, who is passionate about NCO leadership, to the point of I don't even know how to characterize it. He's incredibly passionate about NCO leadership and gets incredibly frustrated when he doesn't see it because he knows what's at stake when he doesn't see it. And so the gunner is going to be the first guest you'll hear, and you'll hear a host of them. The second guest you'll hear on it is Jim Bather, Sergeant B, right? Rose to Colonel, favorite rank, Sergeant. So dedicated to Marine NCOs, leadership, you know, the thoughts of guys who've done it, that'll happen on Friday. So cool stuff going on. All right, with all that said, and thanks to Bob Nielsen for turning me on to Bob DelVecchio, and you'll hear him on the program at some point here in the not-too-distant future. We'll take a quick break. Chris Bronzy on the backside of the break on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.